From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. A new report out by the March of Dimes found that more than 5.5 million women live in counties here in the United States that are currently experiencing limited to no access to maternity care resources, which include hospitals or birthing centers, obstetric care, or obstetricians. And here in our state, three facilities have shuttered their maternity services since Idaho enacted its near total abortion ban in August of 2022. And with these closures, health experts at the March of Dimes are calling this a growing maternal and infant health crisis. Dr. David Pate, the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and the co-author of the book Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak, is joining us today to talk more about this report and its findings, along with other public health issues we need to be aware of. Dr. Pate, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Gemma.
And folks, remember, if you have a public health question, you can always send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. So, Dr. Pate, when you read this report from the March of Dimes, were you surprised at all by these findings?
I was not surprised by the findings because although it's getting worse, we've been aware for many years that this is a growing problem, and especially in rural states like Idaho, where people may have to drive very long distances for obstetrical services. And we've known for some time that our mortality data for pregnant women in the United States is worse than other developed countries. And so obviously, when you add these increasing shortages of obstetricians and other specialists, it's a problem that is only growing. And most recently, what alarmed me is that I saw a notice coming out from the Professional Society for the College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists that was alerting people that fewer people are in pursuing training in this area. So not only are many of these folks who finish training deciding not to come to states like Idaho, Texas, others with very what are considered very extreme abortion measures where doctors risk not only their livelihoods, but their freedom for making medical decisions about patients. Not only are they avoiding our states because of that, but also we're going to have fewer physicians in total to be recruited to states like ours. And so this problem is going to be growing, and it's a great concern.
And Dr. Pate, I want to clarify too, that when we talk about these types of services, I think a lot of times, people think about, of course, it's maternity services, right? So it's a woman who is pregnant, trying to get pregnant, postpartum, all of those things. But also, women go to OBGYNs for other issues besides pregnancy. You go for your annual pap smear. You go for your mammograms. There are, you go for other female-related issues to an OBGYN. So how
Absolutely.
Then is this, right? So how is this, is what I think is important for people to understand, is that there is a trickle down, a domino effect for all women who are seeking health care.
Gemma, that is such an important point, and I'm glad you made that, because in addition to what you've already well outlined, OB-GYNs oftentimes serve as the only primary care physician for women for all of their needs. And so this, as you said, is trickle down. It's a compounding problem with access to care, because not only are we experiencing this increasing shortage now of obstetricians, but we already well know that we've had a longstanding shortage of primary care physicians. So this is only going to aggravate that. And what we know is that when people don't have access to healthcare providers, their health deteriorates, the quality of care deteriorates, and their lives become more at risk. So you're making very, very important points.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, since August of 2022, three medical facilities here in Idaho have shuttered their maternity services. One is in Caldwell, but I'd want to talk specifically about this maternity center in Sandpoint. And here's why. This is, again, why this matters and what this means for patients. Because in Sandpoint, women now have to drive at a minimum, 46 miles to get access to maternity care. And having been pregnant, having had two pregnancies, it's one thing to have to make that drive early in your pregnancy when you have an appointment once a month. When you get into that third trimester and you are meeting with your doctor every single week, and then as you're waiting to give birth and go into labor, I'm just thinking of how this could not end well sometimes, Dr. Pate, if you are in an emergency situation and you've got to get a minimum of 46 miles to access care. Am I being overdramatic here as I, give that scenario?
Not at all, Gemma. This is actually a recognized phenomenon. And so not only are we making it more difficult for these women, think about the fact that many women continue to work pretty close up to their point of delivery. And so now you're talking about, instead of somebody having to take off a few hours, they have to take a whole day off to go to the doctor, and that may be very problematic for them. So are some women going to miss some of these very important visits to manage their care and to recognize problems early? But the most important point is the one that you just made. All kinds of things can go wrong towards the end of the pregnancy. Once the water breaks, there can be issues. There can be issues about where the cord, the umbilical cord, is mm-hmm. positioned. And is that causing compromise to the baby? There can be issues about where the placenta attaches to the uterus that once they get to this stage, all of a sudden, pronounced bleeding can occur, and you don't have time. And so when you have some of these emergencies, yes, you could call an ambulance, but it's still going to take a lot of time to get to a facility that is 30, 40, 50 miles away. Now you're starting to look at, well, do we have to send a helicopter? And now that's very expensive. So there's all kinds of issues here, but the bottom line result will be we will have more bad outcomes.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, you said this in the beginning of our conversation, and also Dr. Amanda Williams, who is the March of Dimes chief medical officer, also said this, and that is that the United States already has the worst maternal mortality rate of our industrial peer countries. How much does access to care matter when we are talking about this issue?
It's huge. So every practicing physician knows that if you get a woman who is already advanced in her pregnancy, end of second term, into the third term, that hasn't been getting prenatal care, there are going to be way more issues and potential problems. And so it directly impacts the quality of care for the mother, but it is also going to impact those outcomes for the baby. And so we already have all of these challenges that you just brought up again, that our outcomes of pregnancy are worse than other developed countries. This will make it worse. And it is so ironic that there are politicians who say that their health and life of that baby, we do away with maternal review committees that try to learn from these situations and improve. We create an environment where physicians that can improve these outcomes don't want to come to our state. We strike a posture that is openly hostile to healthcare providers that if they make a call that is not clear whether everyone will agree, but maybe in that doctor's the mother's life, but then they can get charged. It's up to a jury to decide. That's not the kinds of environment that doctors are going to want to practice in. That doesn't mean we don't need rules. We don't need some restrictions in place, but we have completely dismissed physician judgment, the patient's judgment, the family's input. And now we have legislators who are regulating what is already extremely complicated issues, even for doctors. And it can only result in these kind of bad problems ensuing.
And beyond that, even when you have a typical pregnancy, whatever that would be, right? Because neither of my pregnancies were the same. There is an impact to even those pregnancies when you do not have access to care.
No question. And, you know, the care that women get during their pregnancy is more than just specifically around the maternity issues. It's also determining, well, do they have underlying diabetes they may not have been aware mm-hmm. of, underlying hypertension they may not have been aware of, and other kinds of problems that if we don't discover these and address them, then both the mom and the baby can have issues. And as you and I have discussed many times on your show, there are issues around protections for the mom and baby that are through immunizations that ideally are given during that pregnancy so that it can protect the baby. But if you're not getting prenatal care, you're likely not going to be told about these things and given the chance to have these added protections. And so it's just a whole host of issues, but there is absolutely no room for debate that maternal and infant outcomes improve when patients get prenatal care on a regular basis. No question about it.
I want to turn now to another public health issue, and this is Mpox. I think it's fair to say it is ravaging Africa right now, Dr. Pate. Before we get into what's going on there, can you just give us a reminder of what Mpox is? Because we had an outbreak here in the U.S. last summer, two summers ago.
You're exactly right. So Mpox, which is the new name for monkeypox, and it was done because really monkeypox is a misnomer. It was named that back in the 1950s when we first discovered the virus in laboratory monkeys, but it's because those monkeys were exposed to the natural host for this virus, which is not monkeys. So normally, this virus is in rodents, and rodents that typically inhabit African rainforests. So one of the largest areas of presence of this virus that we know of in Africa is in Democratic Republic of Congo, which is largely has large areas of rainforest. And so this virus is related to smallpox. It's less lethal than smallpox, but it causes in some people a very similar situation where they get sick and then they have these skin lesions that are often like blisters or big areas of rash all over their body. It doesn't have to be all over the body, but that is kind of the typical case. And from the time this virus was discovered to the first time we started seeing this show up in humans, it was back in 1970 when a child in Africa got infected and developed a rash and became very ill. This virus is until recent. You mentioned the outbreak we had in the United States, which was in May of 2022. Until then, primarily, this virus was a zoonotic spread. In other words, you had to come in contact with the animal. It then gave you the virus, you got it, and then you might incidentally infect somebody in your household, but it was not something that spread human to human by and large. What was the shocking thing to occur was in 2022, when these outbreaks that had previously been limited to African countries all of a sudden was showing up in countries across the globe. And another big change, like I said, had previously been from contacting, touching a dead or sick animal. Now we are actually seeing it transmitted sexually, which was a very big shock. And it has only continued to evolve and change. And now we are dealing with a second big outbreak of a different strain, if you will. We call them clades, but different strain of the virus that is now spreading to African countries that never had mpox before. And we now have identified two cases in travelers that have spread to other countries outside of Africa.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, Africa's CDC just recorded more than 100 mpox-related deaths in just 1 week. And the agency's director general says, quote, "This is unacceptable." So this number may not, you know, mean that much to those of us living here in the United States, but tell us why we should actually be paying attention to this outbreak and what you said, that this is a new strain of this virus and how it's spreading.
That's right. So the reason that we should be concerned about this and doing more about this is, if you would have talked about monkeypox in even early 2022, very few people were giving it a second thought because it was causing outbreaks in Africa. But what we saw with the explosion of cases across the globe in 2022, it started in May, what we saw is that It was a surprise that that many cases could all of a sudden be showing up in the United States. And in fact, with that outbreak that started in 2022, the United States had the second highest number of cases of any other country in the world. So we have to change our concepts when we think about Africa. Africa is no longer isolated from the United States. You can jump on a plane from Africa and get to the United States, or vice versa. And in fact, there are hundreds of flights out of Africa to other countries every day. And so we saw 2022 should have been our wake-up call, that we have to pay attention to diseases that we think are only problems in developing countries, because they can be a problem here. And now we are seeing this again. We didn't even learn from 2022. It's now 2024, more than 2 years later, and we're having another outbreak. And this time, the strain of virus that is spreading is more lethal than the one that we saw in 2022. And guess what? Vaccines are only now starting to arrive in Africa. It's been all this time, and we're just now getting vaccines, and we haven't gotten an adequate number of vaccines to get this nipped in the bud in Africa. And until we do, we have to expect that this is going to spread to other countries.
And then there is the bird flu. You recently wrote about this on your blog. We talked about it last week with this new human case that was found in the Midwest. One of the things that stuck out to me in your blog post, though, Dr. Pate, was that even though our CDC has not raised its risk assessment, that's not the case in the United Kingdom.
Yes. There are many of us that are a bit frustrated that the United States, although we were quick to criticize China for their handling of the SARS-CoV-2 outbreak and didn't think that they did enough, I think many of us would say, whatever the limitations of China in responding to SARS-CoV-2, we're doing worse with bird flu. And we just really, after all this alert that bird flu was spreading in dairy cattle. You'll remember that we first talked about this on your show back in March, and this has been spreading. It's still spreading. We have not contained the spread of it yet. And secondly, we talked last week that we now have the 14th case that we know of. And I'm sure there are many more because we're not doing enough testing to know. But the 14th case of human infection now here in the United States from the bird flu just this year. We also had a case in 2022, so 15 in total, but 14 this year. And while the first 13 cases were all people that were occupationally exposed to sick and diseased animals, so we could understand how they might contract this. What was alarming was that this most recent case that we discussed on your show last week that was identified in Missouri, that person did not have any of the contacts that we would expect for somebody to have to be exposed to bird flu. No occupational exposure to these animals. And so, as I discussed last week, that raises the concern. There's two options in my mind if that is true. One is that potentially did this person drink raw milk? Because we know the virus is in very high levels in the milk of those cows that are infected. And we know that the pasteurization process kills the virus, but we also know that in raw milk, it's in very high levels. And there is the concern someone could potentially become infected through that route. We don't know that that happens in humans, but we do know that that can happen in animals. And so has this person been drinking raw milk? A lot of people drink it because they think there's health benefits, which there are not. And we just got the answer that no, this person had not been drinking raw milk. That leads us to far more concerning scenarios. And there's two that comes to mind for me. One, did the person live close enough to a farm and had pets that go outdoors that those pets could have gone to the farm? Because we know that cats that stray on these farms and drink the cow's milk that is splattered on the ground, they get infected and they become extremely sick. We're not aware that those pets can transmit to humans, but did this person have pets that might have had some exposure and got it that way indirectly? Don't know the answer to that question. The other possibility is even more concerning, and that is this already circulating in communities and we don't know it? Did this person get it not from an animal, not from a pet, not from raw milk, but from another person? That would be raising the stakes to a whole another layer, and we don't know the answer. And I wish that there was more transparency about the investigation. For example, I would want all of the contacts of this person to have blood drawn for antibodies to see did anybody else around them have bird flu? Because if so, and if this is transmitting this way, we need to be taking way more aggressive steps to contain this. So there's a lot we don't know, and we really need to get answers quickly.
With that said, Dr. Pate, I also want to talk about long COVID. You have been following studies on long COVID since the beginning of the pandemic, and you recently wrote on your blog about these studies. Is there anything that has stood out to you recently that folks need to know more about when it comes to long COVID?
Yeah, I think this is a subject that has frequently been swept under the rug. And, you know, people tend to talk about when they do their own personal risk assessments about COVID. I hear things like, well, you know, I'm not in the high risk group, which we talk about in terms of people developing severe disease, having to be hospitalized or potentially dying. But what few people seem to realize is you may not be in the high risk category, that is very young or elderly people or those with medical conditions, for severe outcomes like hospitalization and death, but the group of people that is at risk for long COVID is everyone. And actually, it's more common in adults that are at their prime. It's more commonly that we see this in 30 and 40 year olds, often in women, and people just don't really make this connection. And what we have found out is that your risk for long COVID increases with every infection. And so you could get it with the first infection, and many people did back in 2020. But every time you get an infection, that is a cumulative risk for long COVID. And some people think, oh, well, you know, that's a risk well taken. But they don't understand how disabling this can be. In some people, it is just a horrible nuisance. And I've certainly helped people that where it's just a matter that, and I say just, but it's a huge matter for them, where they're not able to get sleep at night are just tired all the time. But there are people whose lives have been turned upside down. Our labor statistics are showing us that the number of people that are disabled and unable to work is growing. And this can have real economic and societal impacts, not to mention the disability that it causes from some people who were, frankly, at the prime of their life and extremely healthy.
And with that said, Dr. Pate, what I have noticed just anecdotally is how normalized it's become of, you know, just getting infected by COVID, right? It's kind of like, it almost seems like people think of it as, well, I got a cold. And whenever I hear folks talking about that, I think about long COVID, right? And well, I still want to do my best to not get COVID so that I'm not exposing myself to the potential of long COVID. So do we need to start maybe thinking about this differently? It almost just seems like it's just become normalized. I mean, 4 years later, right? And yes. Here we are as just, well, it's just COVID.
Well, we do need to think about it differently. So for one thing, we should be doing more to protect our children. There is stuff that is coming out every week, new studies, new findings. We're still learning about this disease. There are other diseases from the past that it took us decades before we really understood all the implications and health risks from certain viral infections, like human papillomavirus, Epstein-Barr virus, even the shingles virus, other viruses that we are now realizing that can have significant health consequences later. What I worry about with children is they're still developing. And so this virus, which we know can impact almost every organ of the body, I think we are being, I hope we're right, but I hope we are being overly complacent to say, oh, well, the kids will be fine, just like with the, you know, other viral infections and so forth. We really don't know that. And I think we should be taking more precautions. And I'm not talking about having kids mask or, you know, be homeschooled. I'm just talking about, can we do things that we know give kids benefit? Could we improve air handling at schools? Can we increase the air exchanges? Can we use HEPA filtration or MERV 13 filtration? Can we use high UVC light? There's just all kinds of options of things that we can do that would not only decrease the frequency at which our kids and their teachers are being infected with this virus, but it would actually protect them from many other viruses as well, and decrease the frequency of them getting sick. And frankly, the fact that parents aren't screaming for this, I am really surprised, because guess what happens when your kids get sick? Then you have to stay home from work and take care of that kid. I mean, why wouldn't you want your kid healthy and in school? And why wouldn't schools want the kids in school, since most schools are paid based on, you know, heads and chairs at school? And so it just makes no sense to me that we're not willing to do these common sense things that would decrease all kinds of respiratory viruses, as well as the fact there's study after study that shows when we improve the air quality in the classrooms by decreasing carbon dioxide and so forth, that the students' brain functioning improves. They actually perform at a higher level than they do when we don't have clean air. And then look at what's been happening lately. We have smoke and junk in the air. Why don't we just invest in some of these simple things that could help protect our kids, improve our workplaces? The biggest thing that I just scratch my head about is going back to our initial conversation, Jim. Why aren't we protecting people in hospitals? And what we're doing is we're getting healthcare workers infected over and over and over again. And look, you can look at the data for disability in healthcare workers. We already have a shortage. Why do we want more of them that want to work not be able to work? There's just so many things that I just shake my head.
Before I let you go, I do want to talk about one of the protections we have, and this is COVID boosters. We talked about this last week because the new boosters are available. But Dr. Payne, I want to talk about something that happened to me and my youngest kiddo. So literally on last Wednesday, went and got him his COVID shot. This child has never, ever had any reaction to any COVID vaccine ever. He was happy-go-lucky, no issues. We get this COVID shot. In the middle of the night, he is feverish. His bones are aching. He's got a headache, all of this stuff. And I'm thinking, like, what is going on? And then I realize, oh, you're having a reaction to the COVID booster. My oldest has always had a reaction. My youngest never. And then I thought, well, wait a minute. The last time he got this, he was 11, which was a year ago. He's 12. And then I thought, do they change the dosage at 12 years old? And then, of course, I texted you and you said yes. But walk us through this, because this is something I think maybe parents and caregivers whose kiddos have now hit that 12-year mark might need to pay attention to this.
Yeah, it's a great point, Gemma. And when you told me about this, it was clear. And So the good news is he's mounting a very good immune reaction to the shot. The reason likely is that all of his previous doses, because you did tell me that he was getting the Pfizer vaccine.
Yes.
He would have been getting 3 micrograms. When you turn 12, you now get 30 micrograms. So it's like wow. He got 10 of the pediatric shots. And so it was very likely that very big step up in dose that now caused him to have a reaction. And of course, what we've been doing with his pediatric shots is training his immune system to recognize that spike protein and to react to it. And so you just gave him a whopping dose of spike protein, and sure enough, he reacted to it. So the good news is he's having a great immune response. The bad news is that the poor little guy had a rough night. So that happens with both of the vaccines that are approved for children under 12. For Moderna, it's a little bit different of a situation because the childhood Moderna dose is 50 micrograms. So those kids have already been getting even a higher dose than what your son got just most recently. When they turn 12, it does get stepped up, but it doubles, whereas the Pfizer dose is increased by 10 times. So that is most likely why kids that were fine when they were younger now all of a sudden are having a little reaction. Not everybody will, but some do. And so, yeah, it's a great point to make people aware of.
Well, and that was the thing too, because we just went after school because he's never had a reaction. And then he ends up missing a day of school. But it also, Dr. Pate, before I figured this out, made me think of, oh my gosh, my oldest always has a reaction. Do I need to prepare myself for him to have an even bigger reaction? But knowing now how you described all that, I'm like, oh, my oldest is probably just going to have the same reaction that he always does.
That's right. And of course, the other option now that your kids are 12 and over is that for your older son, who typically does have a rough go with the mRNA vaccines, now he has the option, he could actually get the Novavax vaccine because he's over 12. And that one, the studies have shown, is far less what we call reactogenic. In other words, he won't have near the reaction to it. So he has another option. Novavax is not an option for anybody under 12. But now that your kids are over 12, that's an option for any one of them that is reluctant to get it because of the previous reactions.
That's a really good point to make, Dr. Pate, before we leave, because I think some people are really hesitant to get the vaccine because they have had such a rough go of it. So just knowing that the studies show that Novavax, you don't get that strong of a reaction, I think that's important.
Yeah, and repeatedly when I've talked to people that have had, really gotten, a day of fever, maybe even chills, very sore arm after mRNA vaccines, and then I've told them, well, try Novavax, they've inevitably told me, oh, I mean, I hardly had any reaction at all to it. And that's been well documented. And so that is an option. And it's also an option if there are people, maybe they haven't had reactions, but they're just weary about all the things that they've heard about mRNA. Now, I can tell you most all of that is misinformation. But if they're worried and it might discourage them from getting the mRNA vaccine and they're over 12, well, then get the Novavax one. That is completely different, no genetic material. That is just part of the protein, and it's based on technology we've used for decades. So get the Novavax vaccine if you're worried about the mRNA or if you've had problematic reactions to the shots.
Well, as always, Dr. Pate, we so appreciate you spending time with us. We covered a lot today. Really appreciate your expertise. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and the co-author of the book, Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.